welcome to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions which are associated with religion and politics, with military and economic schemes, often even with academic myths. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'm going to try to explain the motivations behind the perpetrators and also what these events portend for our future. During the second hour of the program, we're going to return to the topic that we were addressing yesterday so we can determine whether or not these storms were the judgment of God, or whether or not they were just a freak of nature. We will even discuss in this hour whether or not man and global warming have anything to do with the increase of these storms. Our number, should you want to question, criticize, or affirm anything that is discussed on today's program, is 877-376-45. First, I want to begin with an email that may help clarify what we were discussing yesterday, the day before, and we'll begin to discuss again today. This was written by a longtime listener. He said, I wanted to clarify something you said during yesterday's show. In the past, you've cited and talked about how many extreme weather events just occurred or happened because of various natural influences and factors, without Yahweh's direct design, intervention, or intent. But it seemed like yesterday you asserted that Sandy was the result of God's displeasure. Is that correct? Perhaps some other listeners would be interested in hearing your thoughts on this, a continuation of yesterday's theme, if you will. What I wrote to this individual, who has become a good friend, is that the passage I read said that storms would be the result of Yah's displeasure. God said that in Yirmiyahu, the book we now know as Jeremiah. He said that furious storms would come upon us like birth pangs and would be the result of God's displeasure with religions and religious institutions. He's speaking, of course, of Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and socialist secular humanism, and that the proponents of those religious schemes we're going to receive the wrath of these storms. But he was quite clear in this. They said that these particular storms would not result from his animosity with the human religious institutions until his work was done. And so we spent a considerable amount of time trying to determine whether or not his work was done. And what we determined is that he is going to return, and therefore the last of the last days is the 2nd of October at sundown in 2033, which is Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah. That is when we were able to determine during yesterday's program that he's going to return. That is when his work will be done, because the reality is that much of what follows isn't work for God. It is the ultimate design of his heart, which is to camp out with his creation. So, the passage yesterday said that these storms would be the result of Yahweh's displeasure, his personal action against religious institution. Now, the question then which remains is which storms are so created, so conceived. And what I wrote in response to this friend was that I suspect that the current increase in earthquakes and storms, which Yahweh predicted not only in Zechariah, and also Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, but also during his discussions and during the Olivet Discourse, that I suspect that this increase, and this is a geometric, this is a 500-600% increase in the power and frequency of storms and earthquakes, that I think this group were actually built into the original equation for the universe. That they're not something that God has specifically said, okay, I want to create this storm, and this storm is going to come in and hit the northeastern United States, where man is the most arrogant. No, I think it was just literally part of the calculation that during the approach to his return, God sought a means to show that the most powerful of human institutions were unable to protect their devotees, their patriots, their citizens. That even the mightiest country on earth, America, can't protect the homes, the power grid, the lives, the fuel, access to fuel, the basic necessities, even provide food to its citizens. Tumbling human institutions so that those whose eyes are open can do two things. One is, yeah, this is what God predicted would happen, therefore I ought to trust him. And second, to realize, you know, I ought not be trusting these human institutions because they're obviously failing. And so I think that it was calculated to for there to be an onslaught of earthquakes and hurricanes during the last days, just to demonstrate this point. So that's my view on this, and we're going to get back into this subject in a moment. There's a there's a news story out of New York that reads as follows. Climate change was catapulted into the forefront of U.S. general election on Thursday after New York's independent mayor threw his weight behind the Democratic President Barack Obama, citing his stance on climate change for the reason to do so. Now, Barack Obama isn't on the right side or the wrong side of climate change. He's on the side of global warming and the redistribution of wealth that is sought by the Kyoto Accords and wants to impose cap and trade on businesses in the United States. So Obama's on the side of wealth redistribution as a result of the of popularizing the myth of global warming. The global warming is a myth. Climate change is not. Climate change was predicted. It is real. It just is not the result of global warming. So the mayor, Bloomberg, is as wrong as is President Obama in this endorsement. So after refusing to endorse any presidential candidate in the last election in 2008, the New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, a former Republican, now independent, endorsed the re-election of Obama because he believed, this is what we do in politics, he believed that he would adopt policies to tackle climate change and his Republican challenger Mitt Romney would not. Man has a 0% possibility of tackling climate change. We had a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of 1% possibility of making a tiny, tiny, tiny impact in global warming should it have been true and should it have been caused by human consumption and indulgence. We have a 0% chance of influencing climate change. We don't even know what's causing it. Much less know if anything man has done has prompted it, nor anything man can do that would change it. This is stupid and arrogant in the extreme, that human institutions and those who lead them not only want to control people, they want to control the environment. This is his quote, "Our climate is changing. And while the increase in extreme weather we have experienced in New York City and around the world may or may not be the result of it." Now, of what? That extreme weather may or may not be the result of changing climate? The risk that it might be associated with changing climate? I mean, the man's afraid to say what he wants to say is whether or not it may be linked to global warming is the question. But he now knows that global warming is a myth. So he doesn't want to be caught lying. And so he's caught in a jumble of words that make no sense at all. Given this week's devastation, should compel all elected leaders to take immediate action. Action against what? The sun? Are we going to ban tectonic plate movements? We're going to put toothpicks in the plates so that we say, okay, plates, we're able to oppress and control humans. We ought to be able to control the great tectonic plates of the earth. We order you. We demand you. We compel you. Stop moving. That way there would be no more earthquakes. The number one contributor to the carbon gases that are caused or cited to create mythical global warming are come from Earth, from volcanoes. You know, it's a smoldering volcano, not even an erupting volcano, will spew more carbon-related gases into the atmosphere than every car driven in the United States over that same period of time. We're going to say, hey, volcanoes, stop erupting.
Yes.
Should we turn the former god of the of mankind, the sun, turn to it and say, oh, sun, stop burning so brightly? What are we going to do? Are we going to change the Earth's orbit? Are we going to change its rotation? What are we going to do to influence climate on this planet? Do we think we're God?
We don't even have a space program. I don't know if I'd trust us knocking us out of orbit.
America no longer has a manned space program. That is correct. I mean, the hubris of this, you know, the whole mythos of socialist secular humanism is man becomes God. And now man wants to control the universe. This is a universe he not only didn't create, he doesn't even understand. And yet these men want to take action. It's an immediate action, he wrote in an opinion piece for Bloomberg News, which he owns. Bloomberg cited the Obama administration's regulation to curb heat-trapping carbon dioxide and other emissions from cars and power plants as a sign of leadership on this issue. Guess what? Now he's talking about carbon emissions that cause global warming, but global warming's not happening. If you've got to lie to make your point isn't worth making. Myths prevail because the audience of these myths are ignorant and irrational. At least those of you who are listening to this program, those of you who are aware of what is actually true, won't be beguiled by the rhetoric of one Bloomberg or one Obama. This is horrible. What is being said, what is being alleged here, and we ought not buy into these myths. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Shattering Myths. After Bloomberg cited Obama's administration's regulations to curb heat-trapping carbon dioxide and other emissions from cars and power plants as leadership on the issue, which now he's affirming that he's attacking based upon global warming as opposed to climate change, which means now he's on the side of advancing a myth, he also expressed his general disappointment with Obama's performance in the last 4 years. You'd have to be an utter and complete ignoramus not to know that this president has been a total disappointment in every single aspect of his presidency over the last 4 years. In fact, it speaks volumes of about the American people that this utter failure of a presidency would be on the cusp of winning re-election. When Obama came to office, this article continues. This is a BBC report on Bloomberg. When Obama came to office in 2009, he called for aggressive legislation which would put a price on carbon dioxide emissions through a cap-and-trade system, but backed away from the issue a year later. That bill would have set a mandatory limit on carbon emissions, and it failed to get support in 2010 among strong opposition from Republicans as well as some Democrats representing coal-dependent states. This gets right back to the Kyoto Accords, which is all wealth redistribution, taking from those who are productive, giving to those who are not productive, and those who control the mechanisms, enriching themselves in the process, making everyone ultimately dependent on and controlled by those same human institutions. That is what the Kyoto Accords are about. That is what cap and trade are about. And they're all using a mythical war against global warming as the villain. Moving on to another topic. This one somewhat related. In the campaign trail, we found that Romney has now embraced the favorite slogan of all presidential candidates, that of change. Prior to this, Romney was embracing a campaign theme that further affirms that from a religious point of view, politics and religion are different sides of the same coin. His theme was Believe in America, which is a religious concept. Now it is change, which was the Obama campaign, Change and Hope, just 4 years ago. But Obama really can't campaign on change because change would mean booting him out. And the fact is, he didn't change anything. All of the negative things America was doing, he exacerbated. And so now when Romney is trying to embrace the mantle of change, let's kick the bum out, Barack Obama has returned to the campaign trail and is now saying, our work to change America is not yet done, and he is presenting himself as the candidate of hope and change, but all that America can do if we're going to change is change away from him. Now, I just want to have a kind of a quick moment to think about all of this mess that we are in. If you voted for George W. Bush in either of his two elections, just a reminder, your soul is stained with the death of over 1 million innocent people who were murdered as a direct result of our invasion of Iraq and of Afghanistan. And your vote for George W. Bush, if you voted for him, all but bankrupt the country. He inherited a $350 billion surplus as a result of the contract with America, and he turned it into a $1.4 trillion deficit. If you voted for Obama, you elected what is arguably the most disastrous president in American history, someone who made bad situations worse on every front, domestically and internationally, from Afghanistan to Libya, from energy to the economy. His presidency has been an unmitigated train wreck. The notion that this man is likely to win re-election speaks volumes about Americans and how ignorant, irrational, and immoral people, after watching TV commercials that are filled with lies, go out and vote. If you are among the millions who will vote for him this time, for Barack Hussein Obama, your ballot will be the last straw, the final tipping point in America's economic collapse. But sadly, my friends, the man who is running against him isn't worthy. He's wrong on most everything, too, from entitlements to the military, from Islam to Mormonism. We have, once again, the choice between the lesser of two evils, and it's hard to determine who among them is the worst.
You know what?
Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I almost forgot there was another news item relative to the presidential campaigns that I thought was particularly charming. General Colin Powell is now doing ads for Obama, endorsing him. But if you recall, the last time we saw the general, he was lying to the United Nations on behalf of George W. Bush's desire to invade Iraq. Remember, he had all those slides and all those pictures, which were weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be wholly fictitious. And as a result, America lost 7,000 of its sons and daughters in an invasion which made bad things worse. Our invasion led to the deaths of 1 million Iraqis. We brought untold terrorism upon that country. And we took a country that was the natural enemy of Iran and gave that country to Iran so that Iran could become the most powerful influence in the region and so that Iran could complete its nuclear ambitions. All of that is the legacy of General Colin Powell. So if you liked the result of his Iranian invasion, then you ought to follow his advice relative to his presidential endorsement. Yesterday, we were considering the implications of this powerful statement in Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah 23:19 and 20, relative to the storms that God is going to bring upon those who are opposed to him, that he's going to bring on, you know, the very kinds of people that we see in the United States that are the leaders of Christianity and of socialist secular humanism, and in New York City even probably the strongest of the Orthodox Jewish community. And so God's saying that he is going to bring storms and his fury upon those who are opposed to him, religious institutions. The question, of course, was when, and therefore we were trying to determine whether or not the current spat of storms was simply something that he was predicting would increase like birth pangs, and therefore were just part of the original calculation that was part of the Big Bang that created our universe, or were they deliberately directed by him because of his frustration, animosity to religion? So here was the passage that we considered yesterday. It was, Yahweh's anger will not return until he is actually done working, and he takes his stand on behalf of, establishes, and confirms and validates the decisions and plans of his heart. And in the last days, you will all come to see this realization by way of consideration, discernment, and understanding. Now, that statement was all following this statement by God that his animosity was going to roll forth in, as the fury of storms, and that they would increase in frequency and intensity like birth pangs. So, to answer that question as to whether or not God was had completed his work and whether or not this was these storms that we're experiencing now, like the killer tornadoes, of which are unprecedented in American history over the last 2 years, or these killer storms, the tornadoes, the hurricanes that are now slamming against the American Northeast, to determine whether or not those were God's wrath or not, we have to determine when he will complete his work. So we spent much of yesterday answering that question, which is determining precisely the day that he is going to return, when he completes his work. And we were able to determine that that day will be Yom Kippurim, in year 6000 Yah, which is the 2nd of October 2033 on our calendars. We were, for that, we turned to Zechariah, which was the passage that Yahusha was citing in his Olivet Discourse when he was answering his disciples' question on this very subject. And so in Zechariah we read, "And Yahweh, my God, will return, and all of those who are set apart with him. This shall come to pass on a day in which there shall not be a diminishment of his esteemed light. It shall be the one day whereby it is known to approach Yahweh." Well, this statement dates his return, and it tells us that he's going to return on the one day which is known and has been known, is known, will always be known to approach Yahweh, which is Yom Kippurim. You know, each of the seven Mikra play a role in helping us enter God's presence, but we actually are invited to approach him on Yom Kippurim. That is the specific instruction that God gives us in His Torah teaching on this day. It's the day that is known to approach Yahweh. So we know He's going to return on Yom Kippurim. And we went through the history of God's testimony as it relates to determining that He's going to return in year 6000 Yah. We're not going to repeat all of that today. But if you listen to yesterday's program, you'll get the gist of it. And that means that Yom Kippurim, in year 6000 Yah, a Yobel year, is exactly 40 Yobel after Yahusha was last here fulfilling the first four Mikrei. And He's going to fulfill the last two in year 6000 Yah, 40 Yobel later, October 2nd, 2033. Set your clocks. Now, there is a single line, however, in the so-called Christian New Testament, recognizing that Christian is a bogus term and there is no New Testament, which has caused countless religious Christians, and thus irrational people, to forego investigation and consideration regarding this timing. So, where we left off yesterday is we were about to address this head-on, and I'd like to use the remainder of today's program to complete that study. The unreliably maintained Greek translation of Yeshayah's next statement in Hebrew, to the untrained eye, seems to throw everything into question, at least for those who are unaware of the fact that Yosha had been throughout his Olivet discourse, which this is a part of, had been quoting Zechariah, almost word for word. So, this is what is what he actually said based upon what's in Zechariah. He said, "It shall be the one day whereby it is known to approach Yahweh." In other words, he told them, "I'm going to return on Yom Kippurim. Figure it out. It's obvious. But if you don't want to figure it out, then that's the day. I'm going to return on Yom Kippurim." But translated three times. Once from Hebrew to Aramaic, then from Aramaic to Greek, and finally from Greek to English, although influenced heavily by Latin, we find this quote now jumbled. "But nevertheless, concerning the immediate vicinity of that one specific day and hour, no one recognizes, not the messengers of heaven, only the Father, the only one who exists for all time." We have 18 pre-Constantine manuscripts of Matanya. The reason I mention this is that any manuscript that dates after Constantine is just wholly unreliable. It's almost rubbish. If you have a manuscript after Constantine's creation of the Roman Catholic Church, the manuscripts of the so-called Christian New Testament were so significantly altered as to be wholly unreliable. Now, there are 18 pre-Constantine manuscripts of Matanya. The problem is there's not a single one of them in Hebrew. And Matanya wrote in Hebrew, and we don't have a single one of those. But we have 18 fragments, and some large, some small, of Matthew that Matanya, which means the gift of Yah, that predate Constantine. However, this passage was not included in any one of them. There is a record, however, of those responsible for creating the Textus Receptus of adding the "not even the Son" remark to this passage so that it would match Mark 13:32. However, when it comes to this passage, most scholastic tools are thereby rendered unreliable. Unfortunately, there is only one manuscript of Mark dating to the 1st through 3rd century CE, and it ends with the 12th chapter. This reliability problem is further compounded by the fact that Greek was already a translation of what Yahweh said, or Yahusha said, because most of the Olivet Discourse was quoted from Zechariah, which was written in Hebrew. So the best we have is a translation three times over from a manuscript three centuries removed from the actual conversation. And then we must render that poorly attested discussion from Greek to English. It would be impossible for 3,000 years of scribal copyists filtered through the grammatical and linguistic differences inherent in four languages and the passage of nearly two millennia to produce an accurate rendering today. This leaves us with five different ways to explain the variation between Zechariah and what is now found in Matanyah. And the reason this is important is if Matanyah is accurate, then you can throw out everything. You can toss everything that Yoshua said away because he is nothing but a hoax. You can toss away the Torah, prophets, and Psalms because they predicted that Yahusha would cite Yahweh's words. And if this is accurate, he didn't. So, this is a real dilemma. And it's also an overriding issue, because any time you tell a Christian that there is a date certain that Yahweh or Yahusha, and it, when they return, they're one again, there's a date specific that he's going to return. It's Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah. That's October 2nd, 2033 in our calendar. He told us so. And when you tell a Christian this, they will immediately go to this quotation in Matthew and say, no, but nobody knows the day or the hour. And therefore, they will call the person telling them the truth, revealing what's going to happen. They'll refer to them as being demonic and slander them because they just give up and roll over and play dead and stupid when it comes to trying to understand Yah's timeline, his work. And it's all because of this singular passage. So this is rather important, and we're going to spend considerably more time on it. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We are fortunate to have my good friend Larry, on the phone with us. And before I dive into the four ways that you can evaluate the citation as we now find it in Matthew, in the so-called Christian New Testament, as to whether or not we can know what day Yahweh will return or not is essential. It determines whether or not it's worth studying his Torah teaching. It's worth considering what he had to say. It's worth using your brain to analyze the evidence he's given you, or if it's best just to remain ignorant and stuck in the world of faith and belief, because knowing and understanding are impossible. And so this is really at the crux of the choice between religion and reason. And so it's the five ways you can consider and evaluate this passage are near and dear to me. But before we get to them, Larry has called in. What have you to say this fine morning, Larry?
Well, Yana, I have a couple of things to say. First of all, In that passage, it says, no man knows, not the messengers, nor the Son, it even says.
Yes, well, and we're going to get to that here in just a second. You're right. It does say that.
Yeah, there's first of all, Yahusha means Yahweh saves. He's simply Yahweh in a diminished form. It says right in Yahusha Yahu, Isaiah 51:6, Yahusha was, is, and shall exist forever, and vindication shall not be abolished or destroyed. In Mizmor 118, verse 21, I made a public announcement openly acknowledging the greatness of your brand. You answered me, existing for me as Yahusha. So Yahusha is the diminished form of Yahweh, and if you do not think that the Father and the Son are one, then you're believing in the Babylonian Trinity myth of three separate personalities, which is completely untrue according to his words, so you might as well throw the whole book out the window and go get involved in something else. That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, there's several places that even go beyond that. which tells us that with Yahusha, Yahweh will put his words in Yahusha's mouth, so that when Yahusha speaks, he will be speaking not just for Yahweh, he will be speaking Yahweh's words, which means he will be reciting the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And so, if he is not reciting the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, which, by the way, that's the conclusion that informed reason persons would come to on the particular statement, he was doing exactly what he was promised to do, which is reciting the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. But if he was not doing that, and if he added, the Son does not know, then he's nothing but a hoax. So the Christian rendition of this statement, if it is true, then your Jesus Christ is a complete hoax. He is not God. He has no relationship to God. He is an ignoramus. And so you've got to be really careful if you're a Christian and you trip over this verse that says that the Son doesn't even know when the Son is returning. Then you have to disassociate that speaker from God. And the moment you do that, your entire religion craters. So you're in a catch-22 here. A catch-22 is you lose both ways. If the statement isn't true, then your Christian New Testament isn't reliable. If the statement is true, then your Jesus Christ is a fraud. Those are the only two possibilities if, in fact, the statement says that not even the Son knows the time that he's going to return.
Can I interject one other thing here very quickly?
Sure.
In Matanyahu, it says very clearly that the Son is returning. The Son, when the Son of Man returns. Mm-hmm. Correct? That's what he calls him upon the return. The Son of Man. In other words, Yahweh in corporeal form. However, in Zechariah calls him Yahweh. And in Yahusha, Yahu, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, he calls him Yahusha and Yahweh.
Right.
So he's called the Son of Man, Yahusha and Yahweh, by Matthew, Yahusha, Yahu, and Zechariah. That means he is one and the same, period.
Right, and there are many references to the Son of Man in the prophetic testimony that specifically address the corporeal manifestation of Yahweh as Yahusha. We're going to return to this subject right after the break. Don't go away. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
Alex Jones here with a message that could revolutionize health in this country. Going back about a year and a half ago, I began to learn about the incredible health effects of young